Truth about markets, Christchurch, New Zealand, RDU, Max and Stacy. Stacy, what's up?
Oh, it's June 1st.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank God. We're heading in towards summer up here.
Yeah.
Down here must be getting cold.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They're on the other side of the equator, aren't they?
They're on the other side.
I could hear you swallow there. That was loud.
We're eating pastries here as we record this show.
Oh, yeah.
In Paris.
Oh, that's good news, isn't it?
This is going to be like the ham radio of the apocalypse.
You think so? Tell the people more.
Yeah, the podcasting to each other across the world. As the meltdown accelerates and protests sweep the globe.
Yeah, well, you got the global insurrection against banking occupation. I was on some radio shows past week talking about it as apparently in Utrecht, which is the second biggest town in the Netherlands behind Amsterdam, I believe. They had a big, huge protest. The people are on the street fighting against the Dutch banks for being scoundrels.
Rabobank.
Wow. And, of course, they were involved in the IceSave scandal with Icelandic banks. It was both British banks and the Netherlands that were demanding Iceland fork over $5 billion to appease the banking terrorist gods. And then I suggested, of course, in Iceland they should just throw the bankers into that volcano. I'm still waiting to hear back on that suggestion.
Well, obviously the volcano is still waiting.
Is it heating up again?
No, I think they fed it. I think they obviously fed the volcano.
I think they got one coming up. And then volcanic action at the sea of the seafloor down there in the Gulf of Mexico.
That's a volcano.
It's an oil volcano.
Man-made volcano.
Man-made oil volcano, like we used to make in junior high school for the science fair. You take some, paper mache and chicken wire, and then you create some gunk. And you blow it up and...
Yeah, well, you know, the oil volcano really, really reminds me, and we've, our show out today, the Kaiser Report, we discuss this. We liken it to the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about it that's almost a perfect analogy is that the dispersant, and that all the dispersant does is it pours toxins onto the oil spill. And it doesn't get rid of the oil.
No.
What it does is it hides it from view. It pushes it down into the water column.
Right.
Where it actually does more damage because that's where creatures are procreating and, breeding.
That's right.
But that's exactly what we've done with our – that's the entire solution to our financial crisis from the very first go was just hide the debts. If we take the debts off the bank's balance sheets and put them on the taxpayer's balance sheets,
mm-hmm.
you know, the governments have more authority to basically hide those debts.
That's right. Right.
And so – but it just went deeper into the column of debt. It didn't disappear. It went off the surface – which is the banks. Banks
That's
are the
right.
surface of the financial system.
That's right.
But so the debts are still stalking us. They're killing us.
That's right. The dispersant would be, as you say, they're to solve the debt problem, they're throwing more debt at it.
They're throwing more debt at it.
So to solve the toxicity of the oil spill volcano, they're throwing more toxic sludge at it, the dispersant.
They're throwing, yes, exactly. And that just drives it into the column, the throwing more... swapping, you know, government debt for these toxic debts with the banks.
Yeah.
It's still debt.
That's right.
The bad debt still exists. The toxins still exist. It's only made the system more precarious and more deadly because people can't maybe see it.
Yeah, and the only kind of bleeding we hear from BP is that the reason they're taking this approach is purely based on public relations.
Yeah, the people demand it. They don't want to see all that bad, toxic
they don't want to
oil.
See it.
If the same thing, that seems to be the solution many people want, too, is they don't want to see the bad debts.
Mm-mm.
Don't make the banks count the debt. Don't make them record it as a bad liability because then they won't loan to me.
That's right. Don't show the soup kitchens or don't talk about the people that are on food stamps.
Yeah, exactly. Give them food stamps instead, because then it's all private and discreet. Mm-hmm. You can't see how bad the situation is. But more, that's just, you know, a situation where people are hungry. This is a situation where the system itself is being corroded by more and more debt.
Right. The ecology of the economy and the economy of the ecology are both collapsing in real time in a symbiotic symphony of Sisyphistic financial syphilis.
Is that right?
Yes, and it's all happening in real time. The only beneficiary is the U.S. dollar, and at some point, now I made a prediction last year that the U.S. dollar would rally for the first half of this year through the end of June, as it mimicked the action of 2008, except instead of lasting a whole year, it would last a half a year. And I see something today in the paper concurring with my view that the dollar will rally through the end of June before it starts to resume its primary bear market trend down lower. But for the meantime, the dollar is a beneficiary, and this is putting pressure on other currencies around the world. And ultimately, though, the U.S. dollar is another big trend, Stacey. Is the replacing of the U.S. dollar with some kind of world reserve currency replacement, Corexit type situation like the special drawing right?
Well, you know, right now governments around the world are seriously in debt, and they're in debt mm-hmm. because they've taken on the surface debts of the banks. You know, the stuff that we could all see. Now we've moved it to the governments. Now, the governments need to borrow money in order to sustain this debt, mm-hmm. at least servicing the debt. And that brings us to the rush into U.S. Treasury bonds that keeps on happening every time. What happens? Ooh, North Korea and South Korea might go to war.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly, you know, America is involved in that. And what happens? Everybody rushes into U.S. Treasuries. Same thing with Iran. Anytime conflict starts to happen, always the U.S. is their military is there at the center of it all.
Mm-hmm.
It drives money into the U.S. Treasury as a safe haven.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see that America is able to meet its financing needs every time it sends its military somewhere and stokes up chaos?
Well, it creates demand, artificial demand, don't they? It is an exchange to commit acts of war.
It does, and it also is kind of like how the mafia operates. If you don't give us money, we're just going to cause chaos somewhere. So you have to keep on feeding the beast.
That's right. And I'm surprised they don't try to take the city of Kingston public down there on Wall Street, because it's a perfect economic model. You've got drug lords, you know, camped out with guns, blowing away any attempt to extricate them. And looks like a good, you know, they should just take Kingston public on the New York Stock Exchange or something and let everybody participate in this model community.
And the war on drugs.
The war on drugs could be a big winner. If you just, you could offer 10 shares of Kingston as an IPO on the New York, and you could have, let's say, some Jamaican Rasta guy ringing the bell, smoking a big Chiba Chiba when it goes public on the New York Stock Exchange.
Well, that's the thing I don't get is, like, you know, U.S. taxpayers are very happy to pay for a war on drugs because, you know, they think it's, for the most part, any big arrests you see on the news, it's always black people or Mexicans or Colombians or things like that, people who aren't, you know, white guys, the ones that ingest these drugs. But I'm surprised that, you know, at one point they could perhaps offer a war on drugs bond once the sympathy and support for the war on drugs, if it should ever evaporate.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even need, they're not even seeking for a return. All they care about, apparently, is the entertainment value.
Yeah, that's right. They're just using it now for a reality-based TV show. They're not really getting the kind of dividends they could be getting if they offered bondholders a quarterly dividend paid out in cents a million or Colombian gold. And a bond like that would be very popular for hedge fund managers around the world who are getting a little strung out on acid at the moment, pursuing their strategy of the barbell investment approach, which is weighted equally amongst daffodils and psychotic mushrooms. We'll be right back after this break. Boom, 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 boom.
Ooh, I'm sure boom. People appreciated that break after the barbells and psychotic mushrooms. So what's going on there?
Well, you know, the hedge funds, to generate superior returns to their peers, they have to seek alternative investment strategies before everyone else jumps on the bandwagon and you start to see correlation. So this is why you've got these funds now plowing into Sensimillion-backed Kingston, Jamaica bond bombs and other forms of flora and fauna in the investment community growing in the toxic garden of warped returns based on an outdated and broken neoliberal model concocted by sociopaths from a previous century.
Well, actually, you know, I saw a story in the Financial Times a few days ago of a chocolate bond. Oh. The first chocolate bond. I know you made all sorts of circles on it. Max, yeah. Max is eating his financier, by the way.
Yes, his name is Roger.
Many. Not very many people know. Well, they all know. Everybody knows that we eat pastries.
Lecter.
Pastries while we do this show.
Sometimes.
But some people don't realize that we're one of my favorite to... choose to eat during the show is the financier.
It's like a croissant, except it has about five times as much butter. And you see they're wrapped in cellophane often because they quickly dry out for that reason.
Anyway, but there's a chocolate bond
yes.
being offered in the UK.
That's right, from a chocolate store.
They have a five-year bond, and they're hoping to offer a 10-year bond. So mm-hmm. it's their way of raising money rather than going to a bank or the markets, like the listing on the market.
Right.
Is that so? They're offering this bond, and you get paid back in chocolate. So you give them like £2,000 that you might have spent on chocolate over the 5 years,
mm-hmm.
and they pay you back in chocolate.
Yeah, they pay a chocolate dividend. That's right. That's right. Sure. Why not?
So you're making, they said something like about 6%?
They make 6% on the bonds?
You, the investor, if you buy £2,000, you're actually getting
6%.
6% more in chocolate than
okay.
you would have.
Well, you get, if you take the current market value of the chocolate as the retail value of the chocolate, you could be getting 6% on your bond. The melt value of the chocolate is probably 0.00006%. And the money that you might have to spend on buying insulin to treat your diabetes has to be factored into the equation as well.
Not in the UK. There's the NHS.
Oh, that's right. Well, that gets going to have to be accounted for somewhere, doesn't it? There's no, according to my man Eric Pickles.
The rest of society will have to pick up the bill for, mm-hmm. for your investments.
Yeah, that's right.
But that's the global. That's the Western way. That's the neoliberal way, apparently.
What's that, chocolate bonds?
No, you get the rest of society to pick up your bad investments.
Well, speaking of chocolate, according to the Financial Times, the cocoa production in places like Ivory Coast, Africa, due to pollution and environmental stress, is reducing quite rapidly. We've hit peak cocoa, apparently. So these chocolate bonds might be a great investment. If you can get the cocoa delivered to you in a way that is competitive with the price appreciation due to the fact that we've hit peak cocoa on the global markets, you know, there could be an arbitrage there between the rate you've locked in with the cocoa paying chocolate bonds and the spot price of cocoa in the cocoa futures market. So if you buy them enough of them, you could be selling your chocolate back to the store to melt it down to make future chocolate bars if you know how to store the chocolate in a way that it becomes reusable.
Reusable chocolate.
So in other words, the contango in the oil market, and you see people storing oil on tankers,
yeah.
Waiting for the price to get back to the normal spread between Brent and the other often,
West Texas.
There could be a cocoa contango and people storing cocoa in barges offshore, waiting for the spot and futures price in cocoa to resume a normalized curve.
Well, actually, it would. If I recently looked at a map, a heat map of the world.
Yeah,
and
a heat map of the world? Were you at the center of that? Because you're the hottest thing going.
Oh, Max. But, you know, it gives you the average, the temperatures around the world and whether how much they're above or below average temperatures for that region. And some areas of the world were colder than normal over the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
But most were far above normal. And one of the regions with which was most above normal, was that region of Africa where the cocoa grows.
Mm-hmm.
Now, scientists also say this will be one of the regions most hit by rising temperatures, the other being the Arctic.
Yeah.
And northern Canada, those sort of regions are, even on this map I saw, had far higher than normal temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
So cocoa, and what's the other investment? How would you hedge that?
How would you hedge your cocoa bonds?
Yeah.
And the, the cocoa puffs, of course. cuckoo for cocoa puffs.
But that's virtual chocolate.
Cuckoo for cocoa puffs. This is something every child learns in America because of the crazy cocoa bird. Some kind of bird. I'm not sure what kind of bird that was. But he seemed to be completely enamored with his cocoa puffs. And he went cuckoo for them. I guess it's a cuckoo bird. There is such a bird as the cuckoo who went cocoa. Who went cuckoo for his cocoa puffs?
He did go cuckoo for his cocoa puffs.
Yes, and that would be the hedge of your cocoa bonds. If you had cocoa puffs in quantity that were liquid by adding milk, and this is the key to the cocoa puff cocoa bond spread, is to have enough milk to keep the cocoa puffs liquid.
Well, but also, yeah, because if there is a shortage of chocolate, they'll people who will need to satisfy their demand will seek alternatives. It's like a hedonic adjustment, really. So they'll go look for alternatives, and Cocoa Puffs, despite its name, doesn't actually have any cocoa in it. It's just flavored like chocolate.
Right. Well, the natural alternative to chocolate, dark chocolate, would be white chocolate, which is made from cocoa butter. And none of the cacao essence is used in the creation of the white chocolate, as it's known, or cocoa butter chocolate. And so you might see some ancillary movements into the white chocolate market as the hedge against the dark chocolate peak cocoa versus cocoa puff spread.
Well, but my favorite hedge of all, as I said, is if there's a shortage of cocoa in the world, then there's going to be absolute demand for whiskey. They think go long whiskey.
Not after you get through with it. There will be no whiskey left.
Stock up on whiskey because it's good for Armageddon.
Well, Jack Daniels, as a unit of currency, I think has proven itself historically. Back in the Civil War, when they had the breakdown of the currencies in the United States, people were trading whiskey and other goods as a form of currency.
Yeah, that's a Buy American thing, because I prefer Jack Daniels to any Scottish whiskey.
Well, you know, it's interesting, the difference between bourbon and whiskey. Jack Daniels, I believe, is a bourbon. Which is indigenous to...
Isn't that just a U.S. name for whiskey?
No, well, it also gets to the distilling process. There's some subtle differences in how the beverage is made. Now, I could be entirely wrong. I'm trying to dredge from my memory something I read on Business Insider a couple of weeks ago, which had a guide to whiskey and bourbons.
Oh, okay.
I read this, and I kind of think I remembered most of it. But I suggest you go to that article to get the actual facts.
I just assumed it was like a French difference, because it was all that whole region of America was settled by the French, correct?
Bourbon. The bourbon, yes, goes back to the French and the Louisiana ownership of the French, who were the occupying force of that region for quite some time. They were famous beaver trappers.
Uh-huh. And beaver, they still are.
Beaver pelt hunters looking for the elusive beaver and creating beaver coats and beaver-related items.
By the way, in this last minute before we have to go to break, I've been noticing... You know, the euro is now at 1.22.
Of course, you have that show Leave It to Beaver, which is not about French people or Louisiana.
But the euro, so now, buys you only $1.22, right?
Yeah.
So it's down from up at 1.60.
Yeah.
But there's been a lot of American tourists now in Paris.
Oh, boy.
And I'm noticing many, many, many Southerners.
Yeah, well... You know, living in New York, the East Coast, as we know, we were raised in the East Coast of America, and we never really rubbed shoulders with the people in the flyover states.
No, they're not flyover states, but we'll be right back. Hold on.
Oh, okay.
No, so we were talking about all these Southerners in Paris, and you were talking about the fact that you and I come from New England or New York, and you actually see fewer, there's that whole North-South divide, so you see fewer genuine Southerners come up to the likes of Connecticut, and you'll see more of them in Paris.
That's right. People who live in the South in America, when they take a trip, they'll might as well go to Paris, you know. They'll go to Paris. I mean, I've met more people from the middle of America in France and in Paris than I did in New York, you know, because New York is, you know, loaded with New Yorkers.
So is Los Angeles.
And here you have people on their dream vacations, their once-in-a-lifetime vacation to Paris and to go under the Eiffel Tower and kiss their sweetie and eat a have a lovely croissant. So these people are there, and you meet these people, and I've never met these people before while living in New York. I would go out of my way to avoid these people. I think is really what I'm trying to say.
All New Yorkers go out of the way to avoid people.
Well, yeah,
I was looking at Jim Rickard's tweet stream as he went into New York City yesterday.
Yes.
And he was complaining about everybody.
Yes.
But that's what New Yorkers do.
Well, especially people from down south. You know, we don't need to be talking to those folks. They lost the war. We won. And, you know, we run the country. And, you know, they've got their frickin' tea party now, don't they?
Well, they're in New England, too. But, yeah, he was asking, like, why does everybody here have to say use? What use. Do these guys want?
Well, use. Well, the truth be told, at the end of the show, I always say, bye, y'all.
Exactly, which is more of a Southern
thing. It's a Southern thing, which is meant to be ironic.
Is it?
Well, now it's just become endemic. So I started saying that, but I do say it all the time. I think just as a friendly, you know what it reminds me of? Dinah Shore. I used to watch Dinah Shore growing up.
Oh my God, you're from
up.
Like a different generation.
Yeah, Dinah Shore, she was a real Southern charming belle on TV, the Dinah Shore show. And she was popular during the 40s. It was her heyday, I believe. And then she became kind of the pre-Martha Stewart. We had Dinah Shore, who was this everyone's mom type. And she actually had an affair with Burt Reynolds for a short period of time, I believe.
Oh, my God. What has this show become?
So, Dinah Shore would be like...
We're gossiping about Burt Reynolds and Dinah Shore. We're at the cutting edge.
Hi, y'all. It's Dinah Shore, and we'll see you. Bye, y'all.
You're just showing your colors as a Larchmont boy.
It's tough not to have a thing for Dinah Shore, you know? She had those big skirts and those drop earrings and those pearl earrings and whatnot. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say I was watching a show like Hee Haw or something.
I liked Hee Haw.
Well, yeah, you see, now that's post-irony right there, Hee Haw.
Well, if you ever travel through the South of America, it's so easy to just, you pick up a fake accent. Like, you just start speaking like them after a few hours. Because sure. You can't help it.
Yeah, because it's also very kind of a lazy way to speak. You know, the one famous, all-time, worldwide famous purveyor of that Southern accent was in that movie...
Gone with the Wind?
No. Gone with the Wind, yeah. But then, you know, that movie, that Paul Newman movie.
Cat on the Hot Tin Roof?
No. Where he's eating all those eggs in prison. And he's in prison, and the guy comes around and what we got here is a failure to communicate. You know, this was, and then it was brilliantly recreated in Brother, Where Art Thou, I think, when the Coen Brothers movie had a character like that with those aviator shades and the shotgun. And,
what were you talking about anyway? So
well, that's
the
a
point
Southern accent, you know, the sheriff and the bandit, Smokey and the Bandit. That's another Burt Reynolds thing. Then you had Deliverance.
Appalachia, though. Southerners are very polite, like French are very actually. There's very formal language. The French and French people are very formal. You have to speak with the proper you. Form and you have to say, you know, you have to politely welcome everybody and greet people when you meet them. And I noticed that when Amy Goodman was interviewing that Southerner from...
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, they always say ma'am, ma'am, you know, they're very polite.
And that's why they lost the war. You know, they're all busy being polite, and Yankees came down there and, you know, won the war.
What do you want? What do you want? Come on, blah, blah. What's your order? Come on, move on.
Wouldn't take a New York minute, you know? That's because we got the whole, you know, Upper East Coast establishment going on. And,
yeah, that's real New York.
They're all drinking Southern Comfort and getting blasted, hunting with their dogs. You know, we have
Max,
some...
that was like New York up until it became yuppified in the last 10, 15 years. New York
charming,
City used to be like that,
charming
too.
Charming expressions from down south like, that dog won't hunt. Or, he's slicker than deer guts on a doorknob.
Oh, it's like that character Kenneth on...
30 Rock. Rock. Yeah, he plays somebody from like Butcher Holler, you know?
Yeah, West Virginia.
West Virginia. Oh, yeah, Appalachia. Well, so does the character from Mad Men. His dad is from Appalachia. Those flashback scenes of his dad drinking moonshine.
Oh, yeah.
When he was
that was during
adoption.
The Great Depression. Yeah.
Yeah, baby. That's what we're heading toward now. Global Depression.
Moonshine. That's what I said. So we go back to bourbon.
You're equating bourbon with rot gut moonshine?
That's where it all started. It was an innovator who was developing rot gut, and then it became something different.
Well, our landlord, you know, he's taken rot gut to a new refined level with his vineyard down in the south of France here. He keeps trying to get us to accept bottles of this.
See, that's total
sludge.
Propaganda. That's as good a propaganda as, like, that whole American dream and that the American nation is a peace-loving nation, is the fact that a French, that they have good food and good wine.
Yeah.
Italy is far, far, far superior in both respects.
And cheese, too.
Well, French have good cheese, but...
Yeah, but... how much more time do we have on this show? About a minute?
Well, less than a minute.
I'll just mention before we go that the winner of the guillotine cake is being taken care of by the folks over there at Sugar Plum Cake Shop in the 5th Arrondissement of Paris. So, congratulations. You were successfully the first one to tell them that you heard us talk about the show. And until next time, bye, y'all.